Dove Audio presents Sun Tzu's The Art of War, adapted by Stefan Rudnicki, read by Ron Silver and B.D. Wong, with Stefan Rudnicki and Shauna Zerbrug.
Approximately 2,500 years ago, in a time of political turbulence and great military activity, Sun Tzu, a philosopher general of ancient China, assembled his observations on warfare into 13 chapters, creating the classic work known as The Art of War.
This was a long time ago, and times have surely changed, yet this book of the 13 chapters has not only survived, it has exerted an extraordinary influence on the modern world, perhaps particularly in the last 10 years or so. People of all persuasions, from all walks of life, buyers and sellers, soldiers and brokers, backers and hackers, in-laws and outlaws, all have found inspiration and sound practical guidance here.
The period with which Sun Tzu is usually linked, roughly the mid-4th to the mid-5th century before the Common Era, was a high point in the evolution of human wisdom and achievement. Among Sun Tzu's near contemporaries were Lao Tzu, Confucius, Zoroaster, Gautama Buddha, Pythagoras and Pindar, Heraclitus and Herodotus, Aeschylus, Sophocles and Aesop, the prophets Ezekiel and Jeremiah, and Pericles of Athens. Religion, philosophy, music, art, science, and literature flourished. So did war and conquest.
There were fortifications and conflagrations, occupations and liberations, coronations and usurpations. Pharaohs, kings, and tyrants rose and fell. Empires were lost and won. For nearly 50 years, the Romans fought the Etruscans and the Persians fought the Greeks. In China, feudal states were at almost constant war. Dynasties rose and fell with cruel regularity. In such a time, a fine balance had to be maintained between the traditional, peaceful civic virtues upon which Chinese culture had been built and other, more militaristic principles. Even Confucius, circa 551 to 478 BCE, who was probably a contemporary of Sun Tzu and who was known for his advocacy of peace, was quoted as saying, "If I fight, I win."
The historian Sima Qian, a principal biographer of Sun Tzu writing around 100 BCE, said,
"When the Duke of Zhou was minister under Chang Wang, he regulated ceremonies and made music and venerated the arts of scholarship and learning. Yet when the barbarians of the River Huai revolted, he sallied forth and chastised them. When Confucius held office under the Duke of Lu, he said, 'If peaceful negotiations are in progress, warlike preparations should have been made beforehand.'" Sima Qian also stated that
military weapons are the means used by the sage to punish violence and cruelty, to give peace to troubled times, to remove difficulties and dangers, and to aid those who are in peril. Every animal with blood in its veins and horns on its head will fight when it is attacked. How much more will man, who carries in his breast the faculties of love and hatred, joy and anger? When he is pleased, a feeling of affection springs up within him. When angry, his poison sting is brought into play. That is the natural law which governs his being.
Sima Qian also said of Sun Tzu that he was a native of the Qi state. He told this story about the art of war being brought to the attention of Ho Lu, the reigning king of Wu from 514 to 496 BCE. Ho Lu said to Sun Tzu, "I have carefully perused your 13 chapters. May I submit your theory of managing soldiers to a little test?" Sun Tzu replied, "You may." Ho Lu asked, "May the test be applied to women?" The answer was again in the affirmative. So arrangements were made to bring 180 ladies out of the palace. Sun Tzu divided them into two companies, and placed one of the king's favorite concubines at the head of each. He then bade them all take spears in their hands and address them in this manner. "I presume you know the difference between front and back, right hand and left hand." The girls replied, "Yes." Sun Tzu went on, "When I say eyes front, you must look straight ahead. When I say left turn, you must face toward your left hand. When I say right turn, you must face toward your right hand. When I say about turn, you must face right around toward the back." Again, the girls assented. The words of command having been thus explained, he set up pikes and battle axes in order to begin the drill. Then, to the sound of drums, he gave the order, "Right turn." But the girls only burst out laughing. Sun Tzu said, "If words of command are not clear and distinct, if orders are not thoroughly understood, then the general is to blame." So he started drilling them again, and this time gave the order, "Left turn," whereupon the girls once more burst into fits of laughter. Sun Tzu said, "If words of command are not clear and distinct, if orders are not thoroughly understood, the general is to blame. But if his orders are clear, and the soldiers nevertheless disobey, then it is the fault of their officers." So saying, he ordered the leaders of the two companies to be beheaded. Now the king of Wu was watching the scene from the top of a raised pavilion, and when he saw that his favorite concubines were about to be executed, he was greatly alarmed and hurriedly sent down the following message. "We are now quite satisfied as to our general's ability to handle troops. If we are bereft of these two concubines, our meat and drink will lose their savor. It is our wish that they shall not be beheaded." Sun Tzu replied, "Having once received His Majesty's commission to be general of his forces, there are certain commands of His Majesty which, acting in that capacity, I am unable to accept." Accordingly, he had the two leaders beheaded, and straightway installed the pair next in order as leaders in their place. When this had been done, the drum was sounded for the drill once more, and this time the girls went through all the motions, turning to the right or to the left, marching ahead or wheeling back, kneeling or standing, with perfect accuracy and precision, not venturing to utter a sound. Then Sun Tzu sent a messenger to the king, saying, "Your soldiers, sire, are now properly drilled and disciplined, and ready for your majesty's inspection. They can be put to any use that their sovereign may desire. Bid them go through fire and water, and they will not disobey." But the king replied, "Let our generals cease drilling and return to camp. As for us, we have no wish to come down and inspect the troops." Thereupon Sun Tzu said, "The king is only fond of words and cannot translate them into deeds." After that, Ho Lu saw that Sun Tzu was one who knew how to handle an army and appointed him general. In the west, Sun Tzu defeated the Chu state and forced his way into Ying, the capital. To the north, he put fear into the states of Qi and Jin and spread his fame abroad amongst the feudal princes. And Sun Tzu shared in the might of the king.
Although the story is apocryphal, and Sun Tzu's dates around 540 to perhaps 464 BCE, as well as his authorship of The Art of War are in dispute, the events here described echo the tone of the book. The expendability of individual life in the interest of discipline and absolute authority seems unnecessarily cruel, and many modern translators and commentators are quick to suggest that these elements were meant to be tempered by more humane Confucian or Taoist principles. The fact remains, however, that the 13 chapters are about war. This is not a book of general philosophy, but rather a professional manual. It was meant to be available only to a select few, a kind of secret society of generals and kings, and not to the public at large. The book's influence spread slowly to Japan during the 8th century of the Common Era, and from there throughout Asia and into Russia, where it formed the basis of military thought for centuries. It was completely unknown in the West until 1772, when J.J. M. Amiot, a Jesuit missionary to Peking, published his interpretation of the art of war in Paris. Amiot's work was well received and widely circulated, and was published again in an anthology in 1782. Legend has it that Napoleon read Sun Tzu, and this may have been the addition. The first English translation by Captain E.F. Calthrop, RFA, did not appear until 1905, and the Lionel Giles translation, from which this version is mostly derived, 5 years later in 1910. For the most part, the commentaries that follow each chapter of Sun Tzu's text in this edition are from a variety of Chinese sources. Several of those cited are considered Sun Tzu's formal commentators. Among the most prominent are the 3rd century general and military genius Cao Gong, the 8th century tactician Li Chuan, Du Yu, whose commentaries were culled from his monumental encyclopedic treatise on the Chinese constitution, and the poets Du Mu and Mei Yao Chen. Their commentaries are augmented by quotes from other Chinese writers and a handful of more modern Western personalities, including the 17th century French military leader Marshal Turenne and American generals Stonewall Jackson and Colin Powell. It is popular today to think of The Art of War as a practical guidebook for any number of activities that require strategy, from sports and normal business affairs to affairs of the heart. And it can be just that, provided that you are willing to see the world in which you live and work as a network of actual and potential combat zones, where the stakes are high and struggle is the primary mode of being, where no one is to be trusted and survival depends on unconditional victory. War, then, becomes not merely a metaphor for the conflicts of everyday life, but a state of mind. Like the Oriental martial arts, the art of war emphasizes adaptability and flow, grounding the work firmly in those elements of the Chinese tradition of subtle, universal order known to us through the I Ching, the Book of Changes, and texts like Laozi's Tao Te Ching. The very first constant factor discussed in Chapter 1 is the Tao. This is most often translated as moral influence, or the moral law, as the right way, or simply the way. It is the cosmic cycle of energy rotation and transformation, the flow of all things natural. It is the dynamic that informs the path of least resistance. I have called it the force, as much for its appropriateness in a military context as for its popular sense, thanks to George Lucas, of a natural, universal energy with which one seeks alignment. The first move is always the opponent's, telling us everything we need to know about his strengths and weaknesses. For our part, we must be sensitive to all the conditions and circumstances that apply, including terrain, climate, cycles of season and time, personality, and politics. At the same time, we must give away as little as possible about ourselves. All action needs, therefore, to be built upon the shifting sands of deceit and deliberate obfuscation, our motives and intentions hidden even from our own side. In this, Sun Tzu laid the groundwork for all future espionage systems. Sun Tzu places great emphasis on the importance of detail, and illustrations abound in statistical terms that seem of little use to us today. After all, the costs of waging war have certainly changed. Chariots, armor, cooking pots, and other ancient implements are no longer the measures they once were. Cost and gain, however, are still key issues, and these details provide us with a keen sense of proportion, always of vital importance to the Chinese. Perhaps most important to remember are one commentator's suggestion that warlike precepts are not to be applied in peacetime, and Sun Tzu's own insistence that the best way of waging war is not to fight at all. This second is not a pacifist statement, but simply a truth about the costs of war. It is then the reader's or listener's moral prerogative to decide whether circumstances warrant engaging in war, whether there is indeed an enemy, whether the cost of the battle will be worth the prize, and whether we are willing to risk all to achieve victory.
To hear the answer, we must listen both within ourselves and without to the thousands of signals the natural world provides. We must listen to the Tao. We must attend the Force.
Lao Tzu said, "For heaven and earth, undefined, yet complete, formless, standing alone, unchanging, reaching everywhere, it is the mother of all things.
I do not know its name. I call it the Force. Upon further reflection, I name it the Great.
Because it is great, it is in constant flow. Passing on, it becomes distant. Then it returns. Therefore, the Force is great. Heaven is great. Earth is great. The King is also great. There are four great powers in the universe. The King is one of them.
Man takes his law from the earth. Earth takes its law from heaven. Heaven takes its law from the Force. The law of the Force is to be what it is." Chapter 1. Laying Plans. An Introduction to the Five Constant Factors, the Seven Considerations, Deception, and Calculation.
Sun Tzu said, "The art of war is of vital importance to the state. It is a matter of life and death, a road either to safety or to ruin. Hence, it is a subject for study that can on no account be neglected." The art of war is governed by five constant factors, all of which need to be considered. These are the Force, heaven, earth, the commander, and discipline. The Force causes the people to be in complete accord with their ruler, so that they will follow him regardless of their lives, undismayed by any danger. Heaven signifies night and day, cold and heat, seasons, and cycles of the moon. Earth comprises distances, great and small, danger and security, open ground and narrow passes, the chances of life and death. The commander stands for the virtues of wisdom, sincerity, benevolence, courage, and strictness. Discipline is to be understood as the marshaling of the army in its proper subdivisions, the gradations of rank among the officers, the maintenance of roads by which supplies may reach the army, and the control of military expenditure. These five factors should be familiar to every general. He who knows them will be victorious. He who knows them not will fail. Therefore, when seeking to determine the military conditions, make your decisions on the basis of comparison, utilizing the seven considerations in this wise. 1. Which of the two sovereigns is imbued with the Force? 2. Which of the two generals has the most ability? 3. With whom lie the advantages derived from heaven and earth? 4. On which side is discipline most rigorously enforced? 5. Which army is the stronger? 6. On which side are officers and men more highly trained? 7. In which army is there the greater constancy, both in reward and in punishment? By means of these 7 considerations, I can forecast victory or defeat. The general who hearkens to my counsel and acts upon it will conquer. Let such a one be retained in command. The general who hearkens not to my counsel, nor acts upon it, will suffer defeat. Let such a one be dismissed. While heeding the profit of my counsel, avail yourself also of any helpful circumstances over and beyond the ordinary rules. Plans should be modified to reflect favorable or unfavorable circumstances. All warfare is based on deception. Hence, when able to attack, we must seem unable. When using our forces, we must seem inactive. When we are near, we must make the enemy believe we are far away. When far away, we must make him believe we are near. Hold out baits to entice the enemy. Feign disorder and crush him. If he's secure at all points, be prepared for him. If he is superior in strength, evade him. If your opponent is quick to anger, seek to irritate him. Pretend to be weak, that he may grow arrogant. If he is taking his ease, give him no rest. If his forces are united, separate them. Attack him where he is unprepared. Appear where you are not expected. These military devices lead to victory, and they must not be divulged beforehand. The general who wins a battle makes many calculations in his temple before the battle is fought. The general who loses a battle makes only a few calculations beforehand. Thus do many calculations lead to victory, and few calculations to defeat. How much more no calculation at all? It is by attention to this point that I can foresee who is likely to win or lose.
Cao Cao said this about discipline. When you lay down a law, see that it is not disobeyed. If it is disobeyed, the offender must be put to death.
Du Mu told this story. There was a general, Cao Cao, who was such a strict disciplinarian that once, in accordance with his own severe regulations against injury to standing crops, he condemned himself to death for having allowed his horse to shy into a field of corn. However, in lieu of losing his head, he was persuaded to satisfy his sense of justice by cutting off his hair.
Zheng Yu said of planning, while the main laws of strategy can be stated clearly enough for the benefit of all, you must be guided by the actions of the enemy in attempting to secure a favorable position in actual warfare.
Sir W. Fraser tells this story. On the eve of the Battle of Waterloo, Lord Uxbridge, commanding the cavalry, went to the Duke of Wellington in order to learn what his plans and calculations were for the morrow, because, as he explained, he might suddenly find himself commander-in-chief and would be unable to frame new plans in a critical moment. The Duke listened quietly and then said, "Who will attack the first tomorrow, I or Bonaparte?" "Bonaparte," replied Lord Uxbridge. "Well," continued the Duke, "Bonaparte has not given me any idea of his projects, and as my plans will depend upon his, how can you expect me to tell you what mine are?"
Chapter 2. Waging War. The Economics of War and the Importance of Speed.
Sun Tzu said, "In the operations of war, where there are in the field 1,000 swift chariots, 1,000 heavy chariots, and 100,000 mail-clad soldiers, with provisions enough to carry them 1,000 li, the expenditure at home and at the front, including entertainment of guests, small items such as glue and paint, and sums spent on chariots and armor, will reach the total of 1,000 ounces of silver per day. Such is the cost of raising an army of 100,000 men. When you engage in actual fighting, if victory is long in coming, the men's weapons will grow dull, and their ardor will dampen. If you lay siege to a town, you will exhaust your strength. If the campaign is protracted, the resources of the state will not be equal to the strain. When your weapons are dulled, your ardor dampened, your strength exhausted, and your treasure spent, other chieftains will spring up to take advantage of your extremity. Then no man, however wise, will be able to avert the inevitable consequences. Thus, though we have heard of stupid haste in war, cleverness has never been seen associated with long delays. There is no instance of a country having benefited from prolonged warfare. Only one who knows the disastrous effects of a long war can realize the supreme importance of speed in bringing it to a close. The skillful leader does not raise a second levy. Neither are his supply wagons loaded more than twice. Once war is declared, he will not waste precious time in waiting for reinforcements, nor will he turn his army back for fresh supplies. He will cross the enemy's frontier with no delay. Bring war material with you from home, but forage on the enemy. In this way, the army will have food enough for its needs. Poverty of the state exchequer causes an army to be maintained by contributions from a distance. Contributing to maintain an army at a distance causes the people to be impoverished. On the other hand, the proximity of an army causes prices to go up, and high prices cause the people's substance to be drained away. When their substance is drained away, they will be afflicted by heavy exactions. With this loss of substance and exhaustion of strength, the homes of the people will be stripped bare, and 3/10 of their incomes will be dissipated, while government expenses for broken chariots, worn-out horses, breastplates and helmets, bows and arrows, spears and shields, protective mantlets, draft oxen, and heavy wagons will amount to 4/10 of its total revenue. Hence, a wise general makes a point of foraging on the enemy. One cartload of the enemy's provisions is equivalent to 20 of one's own, and likewise a single pound of his provisions is equivalent to 20 from one's own store. Now, in order to kill the enemy, our men must be roused to anger. That there may be advantage from defeating the enemy, they must have their rewards. Therefore, in chariot fighting, when 10 or more chariots have been taken, those should be rewarded who took the first. Our own flags should be substituted for those of the enemy, and the chariots mingled and used in conjunction with ours. The captured soldiers should be kindly treated and kept. This is called using the conquered foe to augment one's own strength. In war, then, let your objective be victory, not lengthy campaigns. Thus it may be known that the leader of armies is the arbiter of the people's fate, the man on whom it depends whether the nation shall be in peace or in peril.
Of rewards, Dumu said, "Rewards are necessary in order to make the soldiers see the advantage of beating the enemy. Thus, when you capture spoils from the enemy, they must be used as rewards, so that all your men may have a keen desire to fight, each on his own account."
General Colin Powell has said, "Nobody in his right mind who has seen war, who has seen death and war, can like war or want war." Colin Powell also said, "There should be no use of force unless success is all but guaranteed. Force should be used decisively, and its application should preferably be short. As soon as the aims are achieved, American forces should be quickly extracted, lest the military fall into a quagmire."
Lionel Giles noted, "As for units of measurement, there are 2.78 li to the mile. And as for numbers of troops, in early Chinese warfare, as with the Homeric Greeks, the war chariot formed the nucleus around which were grouped certain numbers of foot soldiers. In this case, 75 to each swift chariot and 25 to each heavy chariot."
Chapter 3. Attack by Stratagem. Basic strategies, not fighting at all, the five essentials for victory.
Sun Tzu said, "In the practical art of war, the best thing of all is to take the enemy's country whole and intact. To shatter and destroy it is not so good. So too, it is better to capture an army than to destroy it. It is better to capture a whole regiment, an entire detachment, or a full company, than to destroy them. Hence, to fight and conquer in all your battles is not supreme excellence. Supreme excellence consists in breaking the enemy's resistance without fighting. Thus, the highest form of leadership is to thwart the enemy's plans. The next best is to prevent the junction of the enemy's forces. The next, in order, is to attack the enemy's army in the field. And the worst policy of all is to besiege walled cities. The rule is not to besiege walled cities if it can possibly be avoided, for the preparation of defensive screens, movable shelters, and various implements of war will take up 3 whole months, and the piling up of mounds over against the walls will take 3 months more. The general, unable to control his irritation, will launch his men to the assault like swarming ants, with the result that 1/3 of his men are slain, while the town still remains untaken. Such are the disastrous effects of a siege. Therefore, the skillful leader subdues the enemy's troops without any fighting. He captures their cities without laying siege to them. He overthrows their kingdom without lengthy operations in the field. With his forces intact, he disputes the mastery of the empire, and without losing a man, his triumph is complete. And the weapon, not being blunted by use, remain sharp and perfect. This is the method of attacking by stratagem. It is the rule in war. If our forces are 10 to the enemy's 1, surround him. If our forces are 5 to his 1, attack him. If equally matched, we can offer battle. If slightly inferior in numbers, we can avoid the enemy. If quite unequal to the enemy in every way, we can flee from him. Though an obstinate fight may be made by a small force, in the end it must be captured by the larger force. The general is the bulwark of the state. If the bulwark is strong at all points, the state will be strong. If the bulwark is defective, the state will be weak. There are 3 ways in which a sovereign can bring misfortune upon his general and his army. 1. By commanding the army to advance or to retreat, being ignorant of the fact that it cannot obey. This is called hobbling the army. 2. By attempting to govern an army in the same way as he administers a kingdom, being ignorant of the conditions that obtain in an army. This causes restlessness in the soldiers' minds. 3. By employing the officers of his army without discrimination, through ignorance of the military principle of adaptation to circumstances. This shakes the confidence of the soldiers, and when the army is restless and distrustful, trouble is sure to come from the other feudal princes. This is simply bringing anarchy into the army and flinging victory away. Thus, we may know that there are 5 essentials for victory. 1. He will win who knows when to fight and when not to fight. 2. He will win who knows how to handle both superior and inferior forces. 3. He will win whose army is animated by the same spirit throughout all its ranks. 4. He will win who, prepared himself, waits to take the enemy unprepared. 5. He will win who has military capacity and is not interfered with by the sovereign. Victory lies in the knowledge of these 5 points. Hence the saying, if you know the enemy and know yourself, you need not fear the result of 100 battles. If you know yourself but not the enemy, for every victory gained, you will suffer a defeat. If you know neither the enemy nor yourself, you will succumb in every battle.
Of advantage in numbers, Zheng Yu said, if our forces are twice as numerous, divide our army into 2, one to meet the enemy in front, and one to fall upon his rear. If he replies to the frontal attack, he may be crushed from behind. If to the rearward attack, he may be crushed in front.
He further reminds us that a small difference in numbers is often more than counterbalanced by superior energy and discipline. By applying the art of war, it is possible with a lesser force to defeat a greater, and vice versa. The secret lies in an eye for locality and in not letting the right moment slip.
On the difference between governing the state and the army, he said, humanity and justice are the principles on which to govern the state, but not an army. Opportunism and flexibility, on the other hand, are military rather than civic virtues.
Referring to the principle of adaptability in employing officers, Dumou quoted, the skillful employer of men will employ the wise man, the brave man, the covetous man, and the stupid man. For the wise man delights in establishing his merit. The brave man likes to show his courage in action. The covetous man is quick at seizing advantages. And the stupid man has no fear of death.